Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Gallivanting off to London in July 1990, I had decided not to look for work teaching, as I was trained to do, but to dip my toe into the exciting world of business. Taking a career break, before I had a career to break, my father had enunciated with some anger. So while living in a hostel run by a strict Irish nun, I set out in my only suit, kept ironed under my mattress, to get a job. With my 30 CVs and reference letters, won by my local parish priest, I travelled to Islington to attend the milk round. When my hostel friends first mentioned it, I asked them if it was only dairy companies who were hiring, and I was told no, amid splutters of laughter, that this was a large recruitment fair for all kinds of graduates. I discovered, too, from them, that I could drop into Selfridges on the way and have my makeup applied for free if I inquired about their cosmetics. So, looking very dark-eyed and not quite myself, I navigated my way to the large conference centre with my newly borrowed leather briefcase, itself borrowed by my hostel roommate from the handbag stall where she worked. Upon arrival, I was singled out by security, who requested that I open my briefcase. I blushed a pink to match my suit, with graduates standing in line behind me, while I undid the heavy silver clasps, revealing my cellophane-wrapped sandwiches, squashed and sweaty-looking, in the centre of the cream leather interior. At that time, there'd been a spate of incendiary devices planted by the IRA around London, which had left many people on edge. But it went over my head that anybody would suspect me of bad intent towards anyone, with my panda eyes and my pink suit and carrying my impressive briefcase. I did have a plan of my own, though, to get invited to interview by some of the companies, which would often be a three-day process in a hotel. Never mind the job. 3 days with hot meals, soft beds and warm showers would be worth my time, I was told by the well-informed. But seeing the confident UK graduates engaging with the large corporate companies all around me, I felt a bit intimidated. I decided, as a first foray, I should go to the less well-known companies on the balcony level. Trying to appear cool and sophisticated as I walked around the gallery upstairs, looking down at the throngs of graduates, I put on my headphones and turned up the volume on my raspy Walkman. So I didn't hear the tannoy request for everybody to leave the upper level. It was oddly unoccupied, I noticed. I was practically the only person there. As I strode forth, Walkman, briefcase and CVs in hand, I observed directly ahead men in dark suits moving toward me, huddled tight in a hexagon shape, advancing as one unit. They appeared to be talking into their wrists or sleeves. I lifted my head higher and walked tentatively forward, music blaring in my ears, until the hexagon of men put up their hands and waved in a frantic manner. I removed my headphones in alarm and called to them in my strong Westmeath accent, "Are ye all right over there?" This appeared to agitate them even more, and they shouted at me to freeze. The whole conference centre seemed to be staring upwards silently at me. I was bewildered. These men were behaving so mysteriously, I had to find out what was wrong. Just as I took a halting step closer, the huddle of the hexagon broke, and I heard a woman's voice say, "Calm down, everyone." An elegant lady with a warm, friendly expression, angular features, and her hair in a large bun on top of her head, stepped forward, looked directly at me, and asked how I was today. The men surrounding her twirled into new spaces, pirouetting around me, centre stage on the balcony. I replied with a smile that I was enjoying the fair, and she then inquired where I was from, and I replied, "Westmeath in Ireland." I asked if she was looking for a job here today or representing a company? She found this very amusing and laughingly replied that she was just visiting too. She wished me the very best of luck in my job search, then moved around me with her huddle of suited men neatly back in place, except for one man who requested that I accompany him downstairs. He wanted to know why I had not left the balcony when the call was made over the tannoy to clear the area for Her Royal Highness. Apparently the lady I'd just met was Princess Anne, who was meant to walk around the empty balcony and wave decorously from a safe distance. In the office downstairs, two stern men in dark suits spoke into their sleeves and requested I open again my beautiful leather briefcase. The sandwiches, squashed in the corner, looked even sadder and sweatier than they had the first time. But I smiled enthusiastically as I gathered my CVs together.
I first met my uncle, Canis Egan, in 1956, when he stepped off the B&I boat on Dublin's Northwall Quay. The extended family were there, as his homecoming had long been hoped and prayed for. Canis was a Jesuit missionary to China and had travelled there immediately after his ordination in 1945. The early years were hard. The communists under Mao Zedong were taking over the country and missionaries were subject to severe harassment. Mobs would surround the church and school crying, "Go home, imperialist dogs." They were severely taxed and lived on a starvation diet. Eventually, Canis and his confreres were arrested, summarily tried for anti-revolutionary activities and sentenced to death. But as foreigners, their sentence was commuted to deportation. They were detained under house arrest for many months and eventually put on a train to Hong Kong. Throughout this period, my family got little information about Canis, and everyone was most anxious about his fate. Hearing he'd arrived in Hong Kong came as a blessed relief, but it would be another 6 years before he arrived back in Dublin. I remember it as a momentous occasion. I have an image of Canis as a friendly, smiling presence, but recall little else of it. On his subsequent visits home, I got to know Canis better. He told me stories about his time under house arrest. They had been disconnected from the electricity supply, but one of the fathers was a bit of a handyman and had managed to reconnect it illicitly. One evening, word came that the Red Guards were on their way. Canis and his confreres panicked, knowing that if they were caught, it would be very serious for them. One of them grabbed a pliers there and then and cut the main cable. There was a blinding flash, then darkness. Canis attributed his colleague's survival of this event to a miracle. On one of his visits to us, my mother served a lunch of chicken and rice. Canis began to eat his with his dessert spoon, to the disgust of mother and the great amusement of us kids. She told him to behave himself and eat properly, at which point he picked up his fork and began spearing grains of rice without success. We wondered who would win this battle of wits. Canis, having proved his point, said that as you can only eat rice with a fork by using it as a spoon, it was surely better to opt for the spoon in the first place. Mam gave up good-humouredly, but the look she gave us children showed she could read our minds. "Don't you dare," it said. When lunch was over and the table cleared, Canis produced four sets of chopsticks, one for each of us children, and a packet of peanuts. He set about teaching us how to eat Chinese style. It was great fun and easier than we had thought. And like learning to ride a bicycle, once mastered, it's a skill you never lose. In September 1976, I was working as a volunteer in Tanzania when Mao Zedong died. The public were invited to pay their respects at the Chinese embassy. When passing, I stopped at the embassy gates to see what was going on. Hundreds of Chinese workers, all in identical grey Mao suits, were filing into the embassy, many of them in floods of tears. An embassy official, to my surprise, beckoned me over. He signalled to the workers to wait, and he escorted me into the embassy. There I met the ambassador, and he accompanied me into a side room where there was a large portrait of Mao surrounded by white flowers. I was invited to sign the book. While I felt somewhat hesitant, being flanked on one side by the ambassador and the other by the official who was proffering me a pen, I signed and wondered, what would Canis think if he saw me now? I found out the next time I saw him a couple of years later. He was appalled. Had I any idea what Mao had done in his nearly 40 years' reign? Had the great leap forward, Mao's rapid economic and agricultural expansion program, had been a disaster for China, resulting in the death of an estimated 30 million people through famine? During the Cultural Revolution of 1967, the infamous Red Guards turned major cities upside down as teachers, officials and anyone in power was attacked. Thousands were killed, tens of millions of people were hounded and historical and cultural treasures destroyed. From Hong Kong, where he was working as a university chaplain, Canis followed all these events. The Jesuits kept close contacts through informal networks with the Christian communities they had previously served. His retelling of all he'd witnessed was enthralling and insightful. He later acknowledged that great progress had also been made, mostly due to the hard work of the people themselves, but this had come at a terrible and wholly unnecessary cost. Canis would, no doubt, have had strong views about China's current leader, Xi Jinping. He too is developing his personality cult, having his political philosophy incorporated into China's constitution. His persecution of religious groups, both Christian and Muslim, with the Uyghur people a particular target, mirrors the experience of Canis and his fellow missionaries nearly 70 years ago.
Softly, a deep Welsh voice draws us in to a moonless, starless night. In the small fishing side town, its cobble streets silent but for the bare hint of life and love by the slow black, mysterious sea. So opens Dylan Thomas's play for voices, Under Milk Wood. The voices are those of the eccentric inhabitants of an imaginary seaside town in North Wales called Llargub. The idea of a play about such a place had been gestating in the poet's mind for years after a walking trip in 1944, during which he was ferried across the River Taff to the town of Lacarn. Stricken by the strangest town in Wales, he confided to a friend that he could never do justice to the miles and miles of mud and grey sand, the unnerving silence of the fisherwoman and the mean-souled cries of the gulls. The script had to be dragged out of Thomas. A rough outline took shape in 1947, and 2 years later, a frustrated BBC producer bequeathed the poet and his work in progress to a colleague, Douglas Cleverdon. He cultivated the poet's talent, and 3 years later, after dinner with his wife Kathleen, at Cleverdon's home, Thomas read aloud, for the first time, a sizable chunk of the script. Overwhelmed by the force of the piece, Cleverdon persuaded the BBC to offer Thomas 5 guineas for every 1,000 words to finish the script, an unprecedented proposal at the time, but to little avail. The producer even invited himself down for a weekend at Thomas's home in Lough Arne to spur him on, but it was a fruitless expedition. Thomas entertained his guest in the pub, where they drank pint for pint until well after closing time. Almost another 3 years passed before the script was completed, after a fashion. At the first theatre staging of Under Milk Wood in New York in May 1953, the director had to detain the author in a back room to finish the play, the final, just written scenes being hurriedly copied and delivered to the waiting actors. On a Thursday in October 1953, Thomas delivered the revised script to the BBC to allow copies to be made. The manuscript had to be returned to Thomas by Saturday, as he was due to travel again to New York for further readings. Having collected the original, he then went on a pub crawl. Later that weekend, in a very distressed state, Thomas rang Cleverdon at home. He had lost the manuscript in a taxi or in a pub somewhere. The producer reassured him that copies had been made. On the following Monday, Cleverdon handed 3 copies of Under Milk Wood to a much relieved Thomas at the Victoria Air Terminal in London's Cromwell Road. Over a drink in the lounge before his coach left for the airport, Cleverdon commiserated with Thomas on the loss of the original manuscript, to which the author replied, "If you can find it, you can keep it." He then reeled off the names of some pubs in Soho where he had been drinking. During the following days, Cleverdon scoured London Soho and discovered the original manuscript at the Helvetia Public House in Old Compton Street. Dylan Thomas never learned that his original manuscript had been found. Considering, no doubt, that discretion was the better part of valour, Cleverdon avoided the time and expense of a transatlantic telephone call or a telegram to relay the good news. 2 further staged readings of Under Milk Wood were held at the Kaufman Auditorium in New York over the weekend of the 24th of October 1953, but the author was in poor shape from a combination of strain, sleeping pills and alcohol. On the 5th November, he collapsed at the White Horse Tavern on New York's Hudson Street and died, aged 39, 4 days later. Those 9 words, "If you can find it, you can keep it," gifting the original manuscript of Under Milk Wood to Douglas Cleverdon, became the focal point of an action to recover the manuscript in the High Court of Justice on the Strand in London by the author's widow, Kathleen, and McNamara from Ennistymon in County Clare. 12 years had passed since the author's death. "It is hard enough," commented the judge, Riley, "to remember a conversation one had a week ago, let alone 12 years ago." But Kathleen lost her case. Despite his scepticism of Cleverdon's evidence, the judge relied, although he didn't say so explicitly, on the old adage, "Possession is 9/10 of the law." After the trial was over, Cleverdon wrote a book on the provenance of this extraordinary play for voices. In it, he discussed the minute differences in the various drafts of the text. He also recounted how, 2 months after the poet's death, a homage to Dylan Thomas was performed at the Globe Theatre with Richard Burton as the first voice. This was broadcast by the BBC and also issued as a commercial recording. All the participants waived their rights for the benefit of Dylan's widow and children. What Cleverdon failed directly to mention in his book, however, was that, after the play became a runaway success, and before Kathleen took him to court, he had sold the manuscript of Under Milk Wood to the Times Publishing Company for £2,000, a tidy sum at the time. The manuscript surfaced again at the Phoenix Bookshop, a popular haunt of poets, in New York's Greenwich Village, where it was pounced upon by the Rosenbach, a rare book library in Philadelphia. Now safely housed, Under Milk Wood is in good company, for the original manuscript of James Joyce's Ulysses also lodges there. The townspeople, created by Thomas's vivid imagination, were captured, however, for all time, in the mesmerizing cadences of Richard Burton's performance.
It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush! The babies are sleeping, the farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobblers, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the whip-foot.
Il topo mangia il formaggio. The mouse eats the cheese. I'm learning Italian with Duolingo. My friend Maria mentioned that she was learning Italian using the app, and it only took 10 minutes a day. 10 minutes a day I could manage, so I downloaded the app. Duolingo makes learning languages fun because a tiny green bird appears regularly to tell you how great you're doing. The bird tells you you're amazing whenever you get anything right. Doesn't actually speak. Writing appears on the screen. Sentences like, you're learning lots of new words and having fun, so you know exactly how you should be feeling about the whole process. It's very easy to use. For example, you tap a picture of an apple and it tells you the Italian word for apple, la mela. Nothing is ever explained. You know you're right if you get a friendly bing. You know you're wrong if the screen turns red. If you want to recreate the feeling of a toddler playing with a Fisher-Price toy whilst learning a language, I recommend it. I loved it. I was learning words like I uccelli, the birds, and pranzo, which is lunch. In Italian, lunch is both a noun and a verb. Pranzo, I have lunch. Pranzi, you have lunch. Pranza, he, she has lunch. Every lesson I was transported to Italy. I found myself glued to the TV show Inspector Moltabano. The slowness of the plot was tempered by the jeopardy of me straining to understand the occasional word. Turns out actual Italians speak very fast. But gratifyingly, Inspector Moltabano did spend a lot of time eating lunch. At the end of every lesson, a little trumpet would sound, and the little green bird would look excited, and I'd be told I'd earned so many XPs that day. I didn't know what an XP was, but it turns out it's an experience point. Also, I'd earned an ingot, whatever that was. Apparently I could spend it in some virtual shop. I really wasn't that bothered about how the app worked. I was using it for a couple of weeks when things started to take a slightly sinister turn. I'd get texts reminding me it was time for my Italian lesson, and if I wanted to be good at this language, I'd have to work hard. One evening, quite late, I got a text saying that Duolingo really missed me, and it was time for my Italian lesson. Later, I got a message, "What does la borsa mean?" Technically, it means the bag, but I was getting a whole "we're making you an offer you can't refuse" vibe. More messages came saying I'd drop down the league, and if I knew what was good for me, I'd start practicing. What league? I discovered there was a public league. A league where you competed against others and there were precise stats about your progress. It turns out, while I'd been revelling in the Italian language, revelling at a pace of roughly 15 minutes a day, other people had their head in the game. Like Yannick. I'd earned about 200 XPs a week, but Yannick was clocking up about 2,000 XPs a week. and he had a big gold chest beside his name, and Suki had a silver chest, and Ino had a brass chest, and I had no chest. Memories of school came rushing back, and my total and absolute averageness at everything I turned my hand to. Turns out, whilst I'd been rejoicing in the sound of the Italian language, I'd also been languishing 20th in the Emerald League. 20 minutes into Googling the Emerald League, I find out that it's in the middle, of course, of the leagues, brass being the lowest and diamond the highest. I realise I've taken a wrong turn when I find myself reading an article on how to cheat and level up to the next league. Pauline, cosa tu fai? What do you do? I'm not sure how to say what are you doing because it's a present participle and we're a very long way from that. I had associated Italian with a laid-back, convivial lifestyle where I would mangio il formaggio and bevo il vino. This was the exact opposite. The resentment I felt for people who were further up the league and my sense of superiority for those schmucks further down was hardly la dolce vita. 1 week, I found myself fifth in my league. If I'd kept going, I could have gotten to the bronze chest, maybe even the silver. But I'd learnt enough Italian for that day. My head was full. I couldn't keep going. Confronted once again with my own mediocrity, I logged off. But I logged back on the following day. Brava, Paulina. Brava.
On a wet, dark evening in late October 1980, as I cycled down the winding driveway of my workplace set on the grounds of Lenaby Castle, I saw a small, elderly man in a heavy overcoat and cap walking towards me. I cycled past him and then stopped. I looked back at him and he looked back at me. I knew that many years earlier, Lenaby Castle had been an industrial school, and it occurred to me he might have been a former resident or connected in some way. I turned and went back to him. "Are you okay?" I half shouted to him. He said in what seemed to me a thick Yorkshire accent, "I'm over on holidays from Derby." He paused, and then he said, "I worked in that building in 1920. This had me interested. Even in the poor light that shone on the avenue, I could see he was somewhat agitated. Then he said, "We shot a parson here, by mistake. Griffin." He looked directly at me, waiting for my response. Not knowing what to say, I said, "Do you want to come in and look around?" He held up his hand as though to say stop, shook his head, turned and walked away. At the time, I was new to Galway City. I'd heard the Father Griffin Road, but didn't know anything about Father Griffin. Now I was curious. The next morning, I told Chris, my supervisor in work, what had happened. She sat in shock. "You met who?" she said. And he said, "What?" Chris went on to give me a brief history of the capture and murder of Father Michael Griffin by the auxiliaries and or Black and Tans, which occurred in November 1920. There was palpable anger in her voice when she said, "If that man, whoever he is, tells people in Galway who he was and what he did in relation to Father Griffin, this could be his last holiday." Father Michael Griffin was born on the 18th of September, 1892, in Gortine near Ballinasloe. He was ordained a priest at the age of 24 and appointed as curate to the parish of Rahoon, Galway, and chaplain to St Mary's College. Father Griffin was well liked locally, deeply rooted in Irish culture and a Gaelgore. He was a staunch nationalist, but he was also a pacifist who believed that Irish independence could only be achieved by peaceful means. This was in contrast to his fellow curate and housemate, Father John O'Meehan, who was far more deeply rooted in the Republican movement. With the arrival of the Black and Tans and auxiliaries in Galway, tensions were very high in the city, and Father O'Meehan had to go into periodic hiding, leaving Father Griffin alone and vulnerable in covering his pastoral duties. On the night of November 14th, Father Griffin had friends in to play a regular weekly game of cards. The card game ended at 10:30 p.m. and he went to bed. Although it is a mystery who exactly called to his door at around midnight, the visitor or visitors lured Father Griffin from his house under some pretext. It seems he was taken to nearby Lenaboy Castle, then been used as a barracks by the auxiliaries, up the very driveway where 60 years later I would meet the man who claimed to have been among the party who abducted and killed him. Father Griffin was shot in the head and his body dumped in a shallow grave in a bog 4 miles away near Barna, only to be discovered a week later. Father Griffin's horrific murder caused huge upset and consternation in Galway and throughout Ireland. His abduction was raised in the House of Commons, where it was staunchly denied that Crown forces were involved. The following exchange took place between Belfast Nationalist MP Joseph Devlin and Chief Secretary for Ireland Sir Hamer Greenwood, while Father Griffin was still missing. Devlin: "It is clear that it is the officers of the Crown who have kidnapped this clergyman." Greenwood: "No." Devlin: "Therefore, I want to know what steps the Chief Secretary is taking to have this clergyman released from the hands of his officers." Sir Greenwood: "I do not believe for a moment that this priest has been kidnapped by any forces of the Crown. It is obviously such a stupid thing that no members of the forces of the Crown would do it." Devlin: "That is why they would do it." Father Griffin's death was announced in churches in Galway on Sunday, 21st of November, the same day as Bloody Sunday in Dublin. Over 12,000 people attended his funeral. Thanks to our brilliant local Galway historian, Willie Henry, some of the mystery surrounding Father Griffin's murder has now been cleared up. But as Willie has often said, questions still remain. Why exactly did the Crown forces target Michael Griffin? On that fateful night, was Father Griffin lured from his house by someone local? Was his shooting somehow an accident, as I was told by the man I met? And what could he have meant by that? Was it a case of mistaken identity, or did they not mean to kill Father Griffin at all? Although always a dub at heart, I have settled and lived very happily in Galway for 40 years. Over the years, I've kept up a strong interest in Father Michael Griffin. This weekend, which marks the centenary of his death, I'll walk by the house on Montpellier Terrace from where he met his death. As I look down at the memorial plaque on the footpath, as I do every year at this time of year, I think of Father Michael Griffin with honour and respect.
When all beside a vigil keep, lowest asleep, lowest asleep. Alas. Mum's first letter at boarding school. At sea for days, casting memories overboard, I heard a siren call from Ithaca. Soft words and images embroidering September evenings, when I'd cycle home from school, unload my satchel, football in the garden, sound of a car, and Dad returning late, soft shoes shuffling the porch-lit gravel, singing a nonsense ditty for my sake. I blocked my ears and tied up to a mast of insouciance, refused to unravel before that weaveling tune, until at last the song was drowned by distance and the wind being strangled in the rigging.
On this morning's programme, we heard High Hopes by Claire O'Reilly, Uncle Canis by Justin Kilcullen, Dylan Thomas's Lost Manuscript by Justin McCarthy, La Dolce Vita by Pauline Shanahan, Encounter at Lenaboy Castle by Pat Dolan, and Mum's First Letter at Boarding School, a poem by James Harper. The music this morning was It Ain't What You Do, It's the Way That You Do It by Bananarama with Funboy 3. Dragon Songs, Dance of the Yao Tribe, played by Lang Lang on piano with the Silk String Quartet. The opening of Richard Burton's narration of Under Milkwood, followed by Eli Jenkins' Prayer from Under Milkwood, sung by Trorky Male Voice Choir. An extract from Nessun Dorma, sung by the three tenors Pavarotti, Carreras and Domingo, and conducted by Zubin Mehta. And The West's Awake by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.